there's a very well-known sutta from the Buddha's time of a young monk who's trying to find the right way to practice. And so, you know, he goes to one, you know, at that point, there was like all these arahants, you know, fully enlightened people in the Sangha. So you could just go to one and, you know, see what they recommended, you know, for your practice. So he goes to one nun and says, you know, what is it that is said for someone's vision to be well purified? As like a kind of euphemism for enlightenment. And she said, oh, well, it's when one sees the coming and going clearly of each of the six sense doors, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, body and mind, heart. And one sees clearly, you know, the arising and passing of the six sense spaces. Then one is said to be well purified in their vision. He wasn't totally sure, you know, say, okay. And he goes to another arahant, you know, what do they have to say? And this monk says, oh, well, it's when one sees clearly the arising and passing of the five aggregates of form, feeling tone, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. You know, when one sees those arising and passing clearly, then one's considered to be well purified in their vision. Dissatisfied still, the monk goes to another arahant. What does she say? Oh, she's the four elements. When someone sees clearly the arising and passing of the four elements, of earth element, air element, fire element, water element in the body, then one's vision is considered to be purified. Goes to another. What does this one say? That when one recognizes that whatever is subject to origination is subject to cessation, then one's vision is considered to be purified. And this picky monk still wasn't satisfied. So he goes to the Buddha and says, how is it all of these arahants have, you know, supposedly are totally unbound from greed, hatred, and delusion, and they all have attained the ultimate, you know, wisdom and openness of heart, and yet they're all telling me these different things, you know. And he said, yeah, that's the way it is. You know, he said, it's like he gives a metaphor of this tree, the Kimsuka tree, the riddle tree. If, you know, you could have four different people go to the same tree and you'd ask them how they would describe this tree, and just depending on what time of year they went, you know, they would describe it very differently. Or, you know, depending on their personality and their composition, they're going to see it differently and they'll explain it differently to you. But it doesn't mean that they didn't all see the same tree, you know. And that's how it is with the Dhamma, you know, that there is a kind of essential truth to the understanding, you know, of insight and the unbinding of these forces in the heart and the process of liberation. But the means by which, you know, we get there and the doorway for any of us might feel very different, you know, than the doorway for another. And what method sort of works for our constitution and our makeup, you know, might be very different than for another. It's very helpful to hear that, I think, you know, and to understand why we do hear different things, you know, in different traditions and different teachers, and people are going to emphasize different aspects. You know, some of that is going to be according to their own insight and their own composition. But it can be hard in that context still to like understand what to do then, you know, and who to trust, who to follow. It's still like that, you know, in Burma, Myanmar, where I go, and it's amazing, you know, the area that I tend to go to where we have our retreat and do this work, it's like if you can imagine the Santa Cruz Mountains, but it's all just filled with pagodas and temples and monasteries and nunneries and a few villages here and there that are really were only there to be able to support these monastics and these renunciates, you know, practicing in the hills. Some of these pagodas are just very ornate and astounding. You know, some are very simple, very humble, just little caves. You know, it's a limestone kind of mountain range, so there's a lot of caves, you know, that people were able to carve out and practice in, and, you know, for centuries, really. There's an understanding that even before the Buddhist teachings there, this was a sacred place, you know, a refuge for those seeking peace and delving into the mysteries. And boy, you know, you walk around and it's like one temple to another, to a different monastery, it's like there's a wild array of method, you know, and teaching and training, and you know, some more orthodox than others. But I remember the last time I was there, kind of wandering into a little different area, and came upon this really far out temple, and it was very quiet. There's no one around pretty much. And went up this stairway, and it was just this giant Bodhi tree in this kind of pavilion, encircled by this pavilion. And there was just this one woman sitting there, a lay woman, chanting. And it was just the acoustics of this. It was just so beautiful and haunting and wonderful. And just sat down and listened for a while, and kind of each of the places has a very different kind of vibe, you know, of practice. And later on, you know, I went and asked, it's like, what is it? Who is that? Who's the Sayadaw there? What's there? And they're like, oh, that guy, you know, he teaches this weird thing. You know, he's into imagining if the Buddha showed up, that you would be so happy that you would just start laughing, you know, and that's all they do over there is just laugh. And that's their practice, you know? And, it doesn't get a lot of cred in the neighborhood as a method, you know. They're like, yeah, we don't really see that, you know, in the text, but someone's into it and had money and set this guy up, you know. And so it's this thing there. But there's like, so there's so much of that. And there's some part of it that can be, you know, confusing, but also there's something of a relief, you know, that there are all these orthodoxies, and yet there's a wildness to it that's very alive, you know, and can be hard. And how do you find someone that you trust? And how do you find a method that you have confidence in? You know, because it isn't clear, you know, it's like, well, you go to the more famous, you know, monks and nuns there, and that's not always a sign, you know, that sometimes it's a sign that someone's popular, and that can be, you know, some inclination. You know, it can also be a sign that the military likes them and sets them up, you know, and that has its obviously dubious qualities. And so there's it's powerful, you know, to kind of explore and build relationships. And there's one monk who we've come to know very well. He's passed away at this point, but he just had this tiny little monastery kind of next door to where we held our retreat. And just, it was just so quiet and lovely and clear. You know, sometimes in the tradition, there's many of the especially the monks, not so much the nuns, but they're kind of very pulled back. You know, there's this sort of carefulness on one way, the good of like not trying to have it be too much about personality, you know, and this sort of like withdrawal from a lot of kind of intimacy and kind of engagement. And there's something clean about that, but also can be sort of distant, you know. And this Myatong Sayadaw, he just was like so connected and so engaged and so alive, but also could come back. Like we'd visit and pay respects and, you know, ask Dhamma questions. It's kind of like the appropriate, you know, way to hang out. And when, you know, it was quiet, he'd just be so quiet. And then you'd ask a question and he would come forth and engage and be very animated, you know, and enthusiastic. And it was, you know, so contagious, and and yet so clean. And his method of practice, we had the sense, people there had the sense that he was very realized, right? Some people say that he was Arahant, or, you know, like a very awakened, very liberated being. And quiet, you know, he didn't want like a scene. There started to be more and more sort of his supporters being like, oh, let's build a new temple, and let's get some, you know, young, you know, monks come train here. And at some point it just started to get crazy. He just kicked everybody out, you know, and there was just like three of them hanging out in this beautiful kind of crumbling monastery. And he, you know, his offering to us was so much more about attitude than technique, you know, though we would ask him about his technique, and I'll share some of that because it's important to get a sense of the spectrum of what, of all the different methods and approaches, you know. But whenever we would ask him something about technique, he would say, just do what Sayadaw Ilakana says. That was the teacher at our monastery. He was like, just do what he says. Do what, you know, do the Mahasi thing. That is a worthy way. And don't confuse it with what, you know, trust that, you know, and that even though that wasn't his way, there was this respect for another way, right? That was honored and understood that that was still a good way. And there's something so beautiful in that, and rare, really, you know, anywhere, right? Where you're going to hear people not insist on, you know, their way. But his way was, you know, very focused on what are called the four guardian meditations. And you'll see, you know, they're resonant with what we're teaching, and they're different and they're distinct, and there's something important and kind of beautiful that sometimes feels important to share. So the four guardian meditations are, the first is reflecting on the virtues of the Buddha. Reflecting on the 32 parts of the body. And reflection on metta, loving kindness. And reflections on death. And that for his, you know, he passed away at 98, and that was maybe 5 years ago or so, right? So when I met, he was quite old, and he had been doing these forever, you know. And there's something as a package, right, to understand why you wouldn't just do one of them, but why you understand that as a compendium, you know, as a group of practices, how they fill out a certain range of spectrum and how they come and bring to balance these qualities of mind that are trying to be cultivated. And so this sense of starting with this appreciation and honoring of the virtues of the Buddha, and, you know, just how wonderful it is, and how the enthusiasm, you know, of Sayadaw and other people who will practice that way, of just this recognition of the goodness, you know, of the historical Buddha. And you'll also see why we don't tend to teach it so much, right? It's like, it can have a kind of religious feeling that people are like, you know, many people in the West, it's like, we don't need to push that button to like trigger like recoiling, you know? And yet it's like, okay, what is that process? So it's like, thus he is, the Blessed One, worthy of veneration, rightly self-awakened, endowed with supreme knowledge and virtuous conduct, well-spoken, knower of the world, an incomparable leader, capable of taming all beings, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. You know, it's actually rather simple, right? The sense of the Blessed One is worthy, right? This idea that the Buddha was self-awakened, right? That he realized it for himself, you know, this vast knowledge that was attained, and the power of his sila, right, of his ethical conduct. Just that he was well-spoken, knower of the world, right? This, again, about knowledge, a leader. And he said, you know, it's talked about how he tamed himself and he could tame others, you know. Again, sometimes that language is like, how do we feel about that? We're not sure. But, you know, it's like, okay, just like taking in that sense of, well, maybe we do understand that there is a volatility, right, in the heart, ours, in the human condition, in all beings. And what does it feel like, that sense of the settling of that volatility, the calming of it, the stilling of it? Awakened, blessed. Iti piso bhagava araham sama sambuddho vija charana sampano sugato loka vidu anuttaro purisa dhammasarati satta deva manusanam buddho bhagava. And right, it's like when you hear people chanting that, and what Myatong Sayadaw, he would just focus on one, right? He'd have his prayer bead, and for months, just worthiness. Araham, araham, araham. Right? And that practice of, it's like, maybe it's easier to see the worthiness in someone else than our own worthiness. Right? That is not an unfamiliar feeling for many of us. And that's understood here, right? So this sense of like, oh, can we connect with the worthiness of the Buddha? Worthiness of being awakened, right? Worthiness, worthiness. And the more that feeling is enveloped us, the more we are not excluded from that, right? The more Buddha awakened, Bhagava, blessed, Bhagava, Bhagava. It's like you realize it's not personal to the Buddha. There's this way that by rehearsing and practicing it, the recognition of that quality that our own minds can abide in, that we ourselves are infused with the beauty of that possibility, right? That aspiration is actually not outside of ourselves, right? So there's a way in which it's like we might find the sort of external veneration something to be careful about wisely, right? We don't want to lose ourselves in the sense of someone else's goodness, and the danger, we recognize the danger in that, you know. But the idea is actually that we don't lose ourselves in it. It's that there is no self in it, right? That it isn't the goodness of someone else either. And that we have this process. So then you look at this like, okay, so this process of recognition of the virtues of the Buddha, it doesn't have to be the Buddha. It can be anyone who we honor, who we recognize their goodness. Right? What is it to acknowledge that in our hearts? What is it to practice that sense of like, oh, we really value the ethical conduct of this person, someone we know, someone historically, and to see that as like a wholesome kind of enveloping of the heart, right? That when we recognize it in someone else, the more we're able to abide in that, the more we are not excluded and no one is excluded from that. Right, the impersonal nature of these beautiful qualities is something that's uplifting to the heart. And, you know, I think for good reason, there's a sense that we often hear of like, oh, we don't want to just bliss out, right? We're not here to just bliss out. And it's like, yes, right? You don't want to, we're careful that we're not using the practice to disconnect from the hardship of reality, or the truth of our, perhaps our distance from enlightenment or awakening, you know. We have on our practice this commitment to just being with what is. But that if you look at this framework, okay, there's the acknowledgement of the virtues of the Buddha, and then what's next? It's reflection on the 32 parts of the body. Head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bone, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, membrane, spleen, lungs, bowels, mesentery, gorge, dung, brain, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Right? It's like, oh, wow. Like, so not elated, you know? It's like the grit and the reality of this oily, greasy, leaky, you know, body that we're in. And yet it doesn't start with that, right? It's like, let's start with the joy and like how amazing it is that there are enlightened people around, and like, what an inspiration. And how has that happened? Oh, it's like this, right? You know, and just that can be practiced for years and decades, rehearsing these back and forth, up and in, and reflecting on it. And it's that process of disenchantment, right? It's intended to unhook from like this fascination with our body and, you know, trying to perfect it and trying to look like the person we want to be. And it's like, this will not be perfected. The dung is always going to be dung, you know, and underneath whatever we can manipulate is still like the liver, you know, and the membrane. And like, and there's that sense of soberness to that. It's like, okay, what is that reflection? And again, it's kind of as Matthew was saying, it's, we have to find the practice is not just getting, grinding ourselves into the dirt. It's like, where is that soberness in balance? It's not humiliation. It's not depression with the fact of our membranes, you know, and our spit. It's that recognition that that also is true. Right, the liberation of the heart, unbound kindness and joy, care and peace of mind is available. And the truth is also this. And so, yes, the practice of the 32 parts of the body, it will go into territory that's difficult. We repeat these things and it's boring. We repeat it and it's dry. We repeat it and we're like disgusted. You know, it's like, oh, we recoil. And yet that's not the end of it. It's like, okay, that's still aversion. How long does it take to reflect on the body until we purify, right? The attachment to the body being one thing and the aversion to it being another thing, so that we're at peace with this aspect of the truth. Yeah, it's animal nature. It's fleshy, conditioned, material nature of the elements coming and going, arising and passing on condition. And then it's like, okay, in case that starts to like, we start to go down, what's the next one? It's like loving kindness. Whoa, 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 whoa. Come back, right? It's like, oh, love. How beautiful. Right? And this recognition of that all beings are worthy of our care, you know, that none need be excluded. And how beautiful an aspiration that is. How hard, you know, our preferences are, this person, it's like, I love them. May they be happy. May they be safe. You know, it's like, oh, we see the boundedness of the heart. And of course it's painful. And of course we're attached to that, and we're identified with that. And we have our reasons for it, you know, that are right. They're right. But it's like, where is it just dukkha? And where is there this longing to release the heart from that bondage of preference, you know? And yet, what's the practice? Well, we do loving kindness practice. It's rarely just like you just turn it on and you're just radiating. It happens. It can happen. But a lot of times it's just like the other practice, where it's like there's places where it's easy. And there's places where it's difficult. Even in the easy places, it's hard to maintain it, you know, over time. right? Even with the being that we think is like the easiest being, our little puppy, or, you know, it's like you try to practice loving kindness with the easy being for long enough and gets boring, or you start to realize, oh, every being's a little complicated, you know, doesn't always do what you want. Anyway, then there, you know, the undependability of things arises. And so even with the easy being, there's this process that the heart has to go through of finding the resistance, finding the tension, working our way through that, right? Never mind going to the beings that are difficult, right? And difficult in our conceptually, but beings that maybe have harmed us, you know? And that's why the practice, it's like so slow. You know, it's like, stick with the easy being. Don't worry about the hard being. It's hard enough with the easy being. You know, this is this idea of lifetimes, you know, whether you believe in that kind of formulation or not, the helpful part of that is the recognition of how difficult this is and how deeply entrenched these entanglements and preferences are, you know, and that sense of just like the patience and the time it takes to unbind the heart, where it's like, don't worry. Just let's focus on this. Can we feel caring around this? And then when that changes, can we still find some connection of care? When our own energy drops, can we still find it? When we're sleepy, when we're hungry, can we still find care for this being, you know? In the wildness and the wilderness of experience, can we find that reconnection, you know, with the tenderness, that goodwill, you know, and the joy of that? Where is it such a refuge for the heart amidst how difficult things are? Where do we need that buoyancy, that rejuvenation? I recently read a beautiful little poem by Maria Sabina. She was a curandera in Oaxaca. Cúrate, mija, con la luz del sol y los rayos de la luna. Con el sonido del río y la cascada, con el vaivén del mar, el teo de las aves. Heal yourself, my dear, with the light of the sun and the rays of the moon, with the sound of the river and the waterfall, with the swaying of the sea and the fluttering of birds. Heal yourself, my dear, with mint, neem, and eucalyptus. Sweeten with lavender, rosemary, and chamomile. Hug yourself with the cocoa bean and a touch of cinnamon. Put love in your tea instead of sugar and drink it looking at the stars. Heal yourself, my dear, with the kisses the wind gives you and the embrace of the rain. Make yourself strong with your bare feet on the earth and with everything that is born from her. Prepare yourself every day by listening to your intuition, looking at the world with your mind's eye. Heal yourself with beautiful love and always remember, you are the medicine. Tú eres la medicina. And of course, right, there's some people who are like, wait, that's what I thought we were getting, that, you know, on this retreat. I want to go to that retreat. That sounds nice, you know. And that's the beauty and the poignancy of it, right? Where it's like, that is real, right? That sense of like to go outside and like receive the sunlight, receive the moonlight, receive the sound of the wind and the rain and all of the animals, you know, and this sense of, you know, sweetening our experience with love, right? How much more powerful that is than sugar, of recognizing that it's our own minds ultimately that are the medicine, right? The healing of this love and this potential for care and that sense of connectivity and oneness, right? The cohesiveness and the protection of that, how beautiful, how warming, how the security of that, you know. And that is not outside of what we're offering. It's not outside of what we're teaching. It is a part of this path. It's important to see that, like, actually without that, the truth is unbearable. Without love, wisdom is unbearable, right? The wisdom of everything is always changing. Everything is undependable. Everything is out of our control. There's no coherence to this even me, right? Even the mind. You know, someone today is like that phrase you'll hear, right, of rest and awareness. But when you sit and you watch and you watch, it's like there's no rest and awareness. Awareness is not stable. The mind is momentary. It is arising and passing just like everything else. And the instability, it's like, okay, we can see sounds are unstable. Okay, the changing of less knee pain, I guess, you know. But when it's like this is also like, there is no rest in this either. It can be very scary, right? It can be very terrifying. And we can be uncertain that that's what we want, right? And we're like, is that really what we want to see? And it's like, yes, we do. Because when the mind doesn't get forced into that, the mind releases into that truth when it's ready, when the mindfulness is strong enough and when the love is strong enough. When the mind heart doesn't need to be defended against reality with aversion or craving or meanness, it's not in our control. When that happens through this process of over and over again going through these things where we watch the contraction, we watch the release, we watch the contraction, we watch the release, little by little, it's like, oh, at times the mind doesn't need it and things disintegrate and it's fine. But that's only possible if there's enough love, right? And that sense of the buoyancy and the truth also of caring and connection and that other aspect of unity, right? And shared beauty that we have with all creation, you know? Sri Nisargadatta, you know, not a Buddhist, but a sage, you know, in India, famously said, you know, wisdom tells me I'm everything. Nope, he didn't say that. Love tells me I'm everything. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. And in between the two, my life flows. What a beautiful acknowledgement, right, of this path, of this process, of the truth, you know. Because after, in the Four Guardians, after loving kindness, and we feel this, you know, we try to stabilize the mind as much as possible in this unencumbered, unrestrained caring for all beings in all directions, excluding none, including ourselves. Then there's the reflections on death, right? The inevitability of death. Everything that is born will pass away. And there's many methods and teachings around that, you know, in the tradition. And I remember we'd ask Sayadaw, Myatang Sayadaw, you know, well, how does he practice the death meditation, you know? They say you can go to the charnel grounds and watch corpses, or you can just look at everyone you see, just try to see the skeleton, you know, or there are all kinds of things people do. And he said, when I'm doing that practice, on the in-breath, I just remember everyone I know will die. And on the out-breath, I remember, and I too will die. Everyone I know will die. And I too will die. And he said, you know what? I said, what? When I die, I'm not going to be surprised. Ah, ha, ha, ha. He said, I was like, yeah, that's, you know, but it wasn't morose. It was sober, right? It was grounded, but it was buoyed by the love, right? And buoyed by the inspiration, but also not disconnected from the truth of that reality. How hard it is to not land on kind of one side or the other of this, right? But have that sort of understanding that it's like the balance, and that not just the balance, you can only have one with the other. They are really mutually dependent upon one another. So this idea that the heart can't bear, you know, the truth of impermanence without also the beauty of love, that the heart will get attached to love, right? Will get attached to that sense of interconnectivity, of oneness, right? It'll ignore the truth if it isn't balanced by wisdom, right? So this understanding that these two realms are, they're purifying one another, right? And that they're essential. You know, some people's paths may have a little more flavor of one than the other, right? Because again, because of our composition, right? Our whatever characteristics and, you know, we've come into this lifetime with. But that there's no one in who has, you know, pursued this path to its end that doesn't recognize that they are both fundamentally important and both fundamentally cultivated, the wisdom and love. And so we talk about love, you know, metta, loving kindness, goodwill, you know, mostly as a in and of itself, but often also as a stand-in for what are, you know, the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, divine abidings, that are the kind of framework for the broader sort of cultivation of these beautiful qualities of heart. And again, it has this impulse towards balance, right, and towards purification, so that you have loving kindness in and of itself, just this like basic sense of goodwill, of wishing well, right, of not wanting to harm, of wanting beings to be okay, right, and that friendliness toward all beings, all plants, all furniture, you know, whatever it might be. This ability to kind of relate to all experience with that quality of blessing, right? And it has, it requires that sense of worthiness of all things, of being cared for. And then there is karuna, compassion, right? Which is that caring quality, and which is oriented toward the pain in the world, right? The pain in our lives, the hardship, suffering. So it's like, it's that particular flavor of beautiful caring, but for hardship, for pain, you know, in ourselves, in the body, in our own minds, hearts, our confusion. When we see hardship and suffering in others, when we hear about it in the world, this sense of caring for that as a beautiful quality of heart and mind, different than pity, right? Different than the kind of painful, you know, depression or anxiety or worry that can come from seeing the suffering in ourselves or others. Not to say that those are wrong or immoral, but to recognize them not as compassion, right? They're not karuna. They have their place. We understand why we're upset about the suffering of others or our own suffering. It's not irrational. But to differentiate that from the beautiful feeling of caring about the pain of others. And then there is mudita, appreciative joy, joy, the sense of sharing in the happiness of others. Right. So rather than recognizing there's pain and there's suffering, we also recognize that there's joy in our lives, or joy in goodness and success and achievement in our lives or in the lives of others. and that we rejoice in that, right? We feel good about that. And that there's like permission to feel good about good things, about pleasant experience. You know, sometimes when we're sitting on retreat and some like pleasant sensation arises and we're like, uh-oh, I better not get attached to it. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Just like, it's okay. It's like, it's okay to feel good. There are considered just these wholesome pleasures, right? Of concentration, of metta, of compassion, of, you know, all of these. They're beautiful qualities of heart and mind. They're beautiful sensations that can arise in the body. We're not trying to be afraid of them or crush them either. Yes, of course, the mind is going to cling to things. The mind is going to reject things. We have to go through that process as the purification of understanding the suffering in that. But it doesn't mean we don't allow ourselves to feel the beautiful feeling of happiness, right? With something good that happens for ourselves or something good that happens for someone else. And so you have this, like, this caring just in and of itself. And then, oh, there are hard things. Oh, the flavor of that caring just shifts to like, oh, compassion. It's still beautiful. It's still pleasant caring for the hardship, caring for the pain. Oh, something beautiful happens. Oh, caring for the joy, appreciating the joy, feeling the goodness of that, allowing the heart to be buoyed by that. It's so powerful that there is this understanding that the love, the compassion can happen in any of those three directions. Where it's, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and that's internally that we can relate to our experience that way. So that what we see is like nothing need be outside of the scope of our care, right? It's not like this dull, dead laser beam. It's alive. It's like, oh, there's a pleasant sound, I can be care for that. There's an unpleasant feeling, I can care for that. And then there's like, there's this versatility, this fluidity of like, oh, you can care about anything. Nothing needs to be outside of the field of our love. How empowering that is. What a relief that is when we even have a glimpse of that. And then the fourth Brahmavihara of equanimity, upekkha. Right? Again, it's this more sober, more quiet peacefulness that helps put the other three in context so that we don't get so enchanted, so overwhelmed, so sort of like whatever this is, you know, inflated, where it's like, and things are as they are. We can love that which is painful. We can love that which is pleasant. We can love all beings, but that doesn't actually give us power over them. Right? You can't stop pain through caring. Painful sensations will still arise. Hardship will still happen. Loved ones will still die, no matter how much we love them. Right? So it's this, it's balanced by this pool of equanimity, of peacefulness, of acceptance of things are as they are, the truthfulness of that. All of these are in that metta chant. There's that one part where that we know that we do at night where it's like, you know, may beings be free from suffering. May they not lose any prosperity they have gained, right? That's the appreciative joy. That's the mudita. And may they accept ownership of their actions. Kamasaka, that's the equanimity phrase that one repeats. You know, no matter how much we love ourselves or another being, they are the owners of their actions. We can't control, we are not responsible for their liberation. We help, we try to, you know, do as much as we can, but there is a boundary to our power and an utmostness to our own responsibility of liberation. And these are things we practice here. They're things we practice in our daily lives. You know, it's been so powerful. I said earlier about, you know, my mother is not well. And, you know, this winter she found that her breast cancer had come back and is metastasized. And it happened right actually as I was, you know, I sit for a couple months myself in the winter and you know, right before I went on retreat, she kind of got the news, and it was very powerful to kind of be in touch with her, you know, while I was in silence generally and doing my practice. You know, we were, you know, texting and talking and just kind of helping her navigate, you know, a bunch of just like the million decisions that have to happen in terms of medical care and of course, like emotional realities for her, for me. And, you know, it's never the kind of thing you want for anyone on their retreat to have to, you know, be negotiating, you know, such intense things with the kind of world outside. But when it does happen, there's, of course, powerful teachings in it, you know, powerful learnings. And it brought, of course, this the visceralness of how important it is to practice these things. Because it's like, it's so hard to be human. It's so hard to love and not be attached. And it's so hard to feel the pain of attachment and, you know, still be able to care about that pain and understand it and honor it and recognize, of course, we're attached. And of course, you know, everyone we know is going to die. And of course, we ourselves are going to die. And of course, we love them. And of course, they love us. And of course, we want to be able to control through our caring. And of course, you know, people we care about are not, they have their own path, you know. And it's continued. I was just visiting out there and I went with her to, you know, the hospital in Boston where she's going. And it's like to be in this room, you know, where there's 100 people, maybe more, you know. And this is like, this is just the breast cancer ward, right? And you're like, how many floors is this building? This whole area, it's like all, it's all hospitals, right? This whole area. And it's like, wow. But how, like, when you have these practices, how powerful it is to be in that space, right? It's like everyone is here. You know, the realm of the sick and the people who are doing better, the people who are doing, having a harder time, just like the opening of the heart in that and how beautiful actually, right? How poignant, how sad, the suffering, but also the sense of sharedness, right? And the honoring of that, right? That's become so natural. What an opportunity to sit in a room full of people who are, you know, terrified or hopeful or confused or worried or cared for or lonely or, you know, the whole range of humanity, right? Going through this experience. What a beautiful exercise, you know, for the heart and for the people working there and for everyone there, right? To have some sense of shared love, right? And then to not like, but to also feel like the pain and the sadness and the grief is not the only story. I just, my mom and my little brother went to, they magically got tickets to the Antiques Roadshow yesterday, you know? And they had like a super good time, you know? They're not millionaires or, you know, and they're not going to be on TV or whatever, but it's like, something like so fun and joyful and for me to feel that, like, is there something not in the preciousness, right, of understanding how fragile life is that can make us really appreciate these beautiful moments, right, and the joy of these sort of simple, maybe trivial things, just sharing a meal or, you know, any moment of connection and kindness that's beautiful, right? That's how beautiful that is to appreciate the joy of that. You know, she got good news in terms of her, you know, CAT scan, and she's going to be able to take a break from her treatments at the end of the summer, and, you know, wants to travel. And it's like, oh, there's joy in that, right? There's goodness. And yet it's still, of course, there's still this soberness underneath. That's the practice of equanimity. And things are as they are. And of course, there is a way that these kinds of, you know, terrible things that can happen to any of us can help, you know, click in a little bit of like, oh, what's our priority? You know, what are we really doing? And sometimes that can get tight, you know, and it can be like we get sort of too tightly bound to the preciousness of the present moment, and it doesn't have maybe the relaxation of the equanimity. Right? That just by controlling and caring and wanting, we're actually not going to necessarily be able to make the most out of it. And that's why this practice, you know, this, you know, of the virtues of the Buddha and the 32 parts of the body and the loving kindness and the reflection on death, it is meant to remind us, you know, that we don't know how long we have. And even if we have as long as we can reasonably imagine, it's not that long. And that we make use of the energy when we have it, right? We make use of these beautiful protective conditions while we have them. We make use of health while we have it, you know, when we have it. And then that allows us to honor the times where we don't have the energy, we don't have the health, we don't have the protective conditions. It gives us more capacity to be in those times, in those places, and stretch and be humble, right? About the times where we might not live up to our deepest expectations of ourselves, and we wish we were more enlightened than we are, and we have to apologize, you know, to other people for our impatience or our curtness or lack of compassion, empathy. And yet that's just the process, you know, that like we don't have to do these four practices in those techniques to know that that is what we're doing in Vipassana, right? We are open to the beauty and the joy and the aliveness and the wildness and the enthusiasm, you know, and the inspiration we have, the love we have, the care, the compassion, patience, and we're open to the pain, the sadness, the grief, you know, the longing, the loss, the remorse, you know, all of these other more difficult qualities of the heart. We encounter all of them. It is designed for that. It is not just designed for the elation. It's, if you know, it's sitting day in, day out, walking. It's like that it is designed to make us have to go through the full spectrum of joy and sorrow and become more and more familiar with it. So that this capacity for peace, right, is everywhere. The more familiar we are with sadness, the more familiar we are with fear, with wanting, with aversion, you know, with lust, with all of these things, it's like, oh, the more peace we have when they arise. Not through avoiding them, not through trying to repress them or crush them, but finding the conditions under which we can kind of safely explore and understand them. And when we see we can't, when we see we're beyond the ability of the mindfulness or love to like attend to it, we pull back. We bring the attention somewhere else. We go back to the breath. We go back to sound. We bring to mind something inspiring, right? Something that is easy to love. We have these tools for seeing when we're beyond the limits of our mindfulness to be in healthy relationship with what we're seeing. We take a walk, we take a break, and then we come back, right? We're building the strength, right? To have total love and total care, you know, no matter where, no matter what arises internally, externally. And it's just the process of having to go through all the ups and downs. when Myatang Sayadaw passed away, I wasn't there that last year. I was sitting my own retreat and took a year from heading there. And a couple of years later, you know, I'd come back the next year, but it wasn't until a few years later where I went up to go visit his pagoda. So there's his monastery was sort of at the bottom of the hill, and there was this really beautiful pagoda up at the top, very simple, but a beautiful view of the Irrawaddy River and Sagaing Hills, and it's a nice place to kind of hang out. And we went up there and with two friends, and who was this kind of assistant abbot, who's now the abbot, was up there, and he was like, "Oh, you know, well, great to see you. You know, come see Sayadaw." And it was through a translator, and I was like, I didn't quite understand kind of what he meant, you know. He said, "Oh, come see Sayadaw." And there was a new pagoda kind of structure on top, and on the side of it was this little door. And he pulled out this key and he opened it, and he gave us a flashlight. He said, "Oh, go in, go see Sayadaw." And we're like, "Oh," we turn on the flashlight, and we walked in, and it was like, whoa. A glass coffin with his body there, right? This was like 2 years decomposed. And, you know, still in his robes and his glasses, you know, that he always wore. And I've never seen that. You know, I've never seen a human body at that level of decomposition, and the humidity inside, and you know, the smell of it. I mean, it was so visceral, you know. And it was just like so pure. It's like, you know, and even in Burma, the tendency for most, you know, honored, you know, monks and nuns is to be burnt, you know, cremated. And there's definitely people will search through the, you know, the dust to find, you know, jewels and little miraculous things. And this is like not that, right? This is like, come and watch like the truth of what happened. And it's not, this is it. It's just the body decomposing. And it's just like, and what's amazing is also just the space. Before even going in there, there's something about this space where you show up there and you're such a relief. You want to just curl up and fall asleep and hang out in this little pavilion. And you can't say why, because it's just so clean. It feels, it's like, it feels like the opposite of like a nuclear reactor. You know, you're like, oh my God, what? It's this feeling of feeling so relieved and clean and pure, you know, and that it's like, that's at the heart of it. It's not to recoil. It's not to be ashamed of, you know, that his last teaching, you know, his last offering was this. It's just like, my decomposing body, it's not me. It's nothing. It's just natural. And bear that, witness that, take it in and see the beauty that comes from that, the goodness, the relief of thinking this is anything more than that. And what that opens in terms of the heart, in terms of love, in terms of our ability to have this kindness and joy and peacefulness with things, right? That it's so interrelated with that same process of the truth. And how trustworthy that is. It's why I've always just trusted this practice so much. It's because you're not trying to make anything happen. It's just trying to be more and more honest and more clear about how being able to see what's happening. Less and less delusion, you know, less and less tricks, less and less fancy. And the release of the heart that happens through that, and how beautiful and how pure that is. Let's just sit for a moment. Enjoy some walking, some nourishment for your bodies. Take care of yourselves, and we'll see you back in a little while.